Hello and welcome to this special edition of Network Europe. To mark All Saints Day this week, we have a program dedicated to dealing with death. But don't worry, this is an uplifting program. Here's what's coming up. Life might not be a picnic, but we visit a Dutch funeral that is. We visit Vienna's Funeral Museum, where in death, as in life, all is theatre.
We want to be forever. We want to be for eternity. We want to give a sign to the other people, oh, look here, what have the people done?
With Transylvania in the backyard, you might expect Romania to be a ghoulish place to die, but that's not so.
I've lived for 49 years. That's what I want to tell you. For as long as I lived, I used to skin sheep. I prepared good meat. Good meat for you to eat.
Plus, our briefing from Brussels and this month's new quiz, this time exercising a different part of your brain. So stay tuned to Network Europe, coming to you from Hilversum in Holland with me, Richard Walker. For those not paying full attention to the Christian calendar, All Saints Day is marked this week. The day honours those who've made it up to heaven, and it's generally a time for family and friends to visit the grave of a loved one. This Day of the Dead's been acknowledged for around 1400 years, and in that time a rich culture's developed around dealing with the death of someone close to you. You might not think this is terribly interesting for non-Christians, of course, but whether you're religious or not, you'll probably have a connection to the customs of saying goodbye to a loved one. Now, the Dutch have drawn inspiration in the past few years from funeral customs in Mexico and Spain. The project Alle Zeilen Alom, or All Saints Everywhere, is an effort to honour and remember dead relatives in a creative, communal way. There are events at 5 cemeteries this year where you can hear a cappella choirs, see movies and pictures projected onto ice tablets hanging from trees, and of course there are lots of fires, not near the ice tablets, presumably. Johan Housinger from Radio Netherlands Worldwide went along to one such event this week and spoke to the project's leader, Ida van der Lee.
I feel the atmosphere of a kind of large picnic with a lot of lights, candle lights, people cozy, chatting with each other, drinking glue wine, as you do. Yeah. You are the initiator of this whole project. Why?
Yeah, I think the death are a bit forgotten, and it's a lonely process for the people, the family who are still alive. And I think when you have this togetherness, this collective energy, it helps so much, and it can be so beautiful to think about the dead, what kind of inspiration did they give you, what kind of energy is still there. And I think to think about the past and about memories, it's just a healthy thing to do once in a while, and it brings life in balance.
Now, we always think we, the Dutch, are much too Calvinistic for this kind of light-weighted rituals relating to death.
Yeah, that's true. Some people, they don't like it, and they... But no, they don't come, I don't mind. But the Catholics are a bit easier about these things, and they come. But the experience is the people who are coming, they taste the atmosphere and are very enthusiastic.
Now, I understood you give the people suggestions about creating an ambience around the graves, and how to honor their death or celebrate the death, if you want to call it like that. Yeah. Can you give a few examples?
Yeah, for example, we had kind of workshops and a poet. He helped the people with writing. Yeah,
writing short
story,
poets.
Poems. Mm. But another artist had kind of lights, kind of lanterns, with photos from the death, and a bit of some photoshopping on the computer and some folding the paper and around the candle, and suddenly there was a nice lantern with the portrait from the dead person on it. Mm. So people said, oh, it's very concrete and I can use it. So that's first we had a kind of inspiration meetings, and we said, now, how do you celebrate Christmas? How do you celebrate your birthday? So, on the same way, you can think about this. You can make a fire and a party tent and whatever, so that they are not afraid to do too much, to try to make them enthusiastic.
Now, as well as the funeral picnics, we heard about a funeral directors and coffin makers in Amsterdam who also approaches the subject of dealing with death in a modern way. Walter Carpe runs an undertaker's in the Dockland area of Amsterdam and looks for different ways to express grief in an artistic way and at the same time bring back some of the intimacy people used to benefit from before everybody stopped believing in God.
When we started to think as artists about what would be a nice monument or a nice coffin, we discovered we had not any idea about death. Our cultural baggage was quite empty. We had not the slightest idea how to approach death, what to think about it, and how to deal with it. So our discovery, discovering things started. It was in a time when it was quite usual in Holland, I think in whole northwestern Europe, to approach death at least as possible. So it was quite common that there was a great distance between relatives, family and friends, and the person who died. It was quite common that you died in a hospital and you went to a mortuarium and the family was phoned to make an appointment to visit the past one for half an hour. And they were not even involved in organizing the funeral. And that was very strange for us. And there we started to think what to do. But the first thing in general was to look for ways to be more intimate with the death, the dead person.
So does that mean making a connection with the dead person's life? Because I noticed just coming into your workshop just now, a couple of coffins. One of them looks as if it's been painted with leaves. It looks like somebody who was really fond of rural environments, maybe. And another one's made of wicker. Yeah. So maybe somebody who weaved baskets, sure, or something. Sure. Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Well, these are possibilities. But maybe more better examples. A nice example is to, instead of bringing a dead person to a mortuary, take it at home and leave the person at home a few days before the burial or the cremation.
Which the Catholics have done for a long time with their wakes, of course.
It was usual in Holland in 100 years ago. But in the modern times, there was no place and time for death.
You mentioned that you thought that attitudes towards death started changing 15, 20 years ago. So obviously this is linked to religion and the fact that fewer people believe in God nowadays. So the things that you do are kind of filling that gap.
Well, they don't believe in God, maybe, but they believe in love. They believe in family love and love with their friends. And it can be a celebration of love, saying goodbye in a really nice and intimate way.
Is it an uplifting job? I imagine lots of people will assume that you're quite a depressing person, or maybe
no,
depressed.
No, not at all. It is a quite interesting job. No, I'm not depressed in any way.
Now, the Europe of the 19th century didn't have this need to search for ways of grieving. Death wasn't hidden or taboo in the way it sometimes is now. Nowhere was this perhaps more true than in Vienna, home to one of Europe's largest cemeteries. Viennese funerals are often grand affairs with high fashion and live music. In fact, the tradition is so rich that the Austrian capital has created a funeral museum. Kerry Skyring paid a visit for Network Europe.
In Vienna's funeral museum, there's a remarkable exhibit, a clockwork funeral procession dating from 1855. It's a wind-up toy designed for children. Funeral music plays as a procession of paper figures passes in front of the viewer. Vittigo Keller is the curator of the museum.
You see the different horse riders, the music groups. You see the horse, if it should be living, of the dead person. He was taken in a black robe and conducted in the funeral procession too. And in the background, in the windows, you have to imagine the people looking at this funeral like the incineration in theater and opera. It was a toy. A toy for the child. They could exercise the beautiful funeral because with 4 or 5 years they were accompanying the parents lively in reality at the funeral.
The idea of a toy funeral procession as a gift for a child is today almost unthinkable. But in the Vienna of a century and a half ago, death was on everyone's doorstep.
death has been part of everyday life. You could find every day, really. And you find it from the house of the dead in the beautiful procession through the city to the different cemeteries. And we have about 52 different cemeteries here in Vienna. So we had a really historical culture. And since the Second World War, there were the house layouts forbidden. And now is death isolated and taken out of the society and centered at the cemeteries. That's the difference to historical times.
But grand funerals still take place in Vienna.
I'm sorry to have to inform you that the president, Dr. Thomas Klestil, has died on July 6th at 11:33 p.m.
The most recent state funeral was that of President Thomas Klestil, who died in office 3 years ago. His funeral was grand, with heads of state and royalty attending, an occasion for national mourning, but also pomp and ceremony. And a showcase for Austria's great musical tradition. Some of the most beautiful music deals with death and what comes after. Thomas Klestil favored Haydn's Requiem, but few pieces of music are more favored at funerals than Mozart's Requiem. The Viennese have yet to live down giving Mozart a pauper's funeral, but for themselves they often express a desire to be a beautiful corpse, eine schöne Leiche. The phrase comes up in everyday conversation. They seem to say, well, things may not be so great in this life, but I'm going to die beautiful. In the bookshop at the Vienna Funeral Museum, you can buy books on the tradition of the beautiful corpse and guidebooks to Vienna's many cemeteries and a book titled Vienna Does Death Differently. At the beginning of November, like many Catholic countries, Austria takes a holiday, All Saints' Day. It's the day when most people visit the family grave. The weather is often appropriately dull and misty, but the cemeteries are brightened by thousands of candles burning in their red containers. The Funeral Museum shows that death in Vienna is for many a piece of theatre and a work of art, and also a way of coping with the unbearable and of showing that we're really still here even after we've gone.
We want to be forever. We want to be for eternity. We want to give a sign to the other people, oh, look here, what have the people done? What are the people?
Kerry Skyring at the Vienna Funeral Museum for Deutsche Welle Radio.
And from death as theatre in Austria, we head due east to northern Romania, where the locals take death far less seriously and have no apparent longing for immortality. In the region of Maramures, people are very relaxed about death. When they die, they're buried in what's called a merry cemetery, where wooden crosses are painted blue and the epitaphs written on them are often amusing in a deadpan way. Pardon that pun. For the villagers of Sapunța, a life can be summed up in a few humorous rhymed verses. Radio Romania International's Iulian Murusan made the journey to find out more for Network Europe.
I've lived for 49 years. That's what I want to tell you. My name was George Bosului. For as long as I lived, I used to skin sheep. I prepared good meat for you to eat. And in 1939, I went to sleep. That's a very lame translation of an epitaph from the famous Merry Cemetery. It's my translation. I have to say that it's almost impossible to render the full naivete of these rhymed verses, fraught with archaisms and sometimes even spelling mistakes. But for Romanians it works. This cemetery turns death from black into blue. Elisabeta is 77 years old. She has everything ready for her death, except for the epitaph. She hasn't made up her mind whether to make any suggestions to the local artist who will paint her cross and write her epitaph.
I don't know what to write as long as I'm alive. I guess my children will write whatever they want. Maybe I will write something myself on a piece of paper, but I don't know. I have three kids. Ever since they were young, at that time I was working up in the forest. Well, ever since then, I've been preparing for death. And today I'm still alive. I don't know when I will go. Only God knows that.
I have never heard anyone being so at ease talking about death. The people of Sapunsa are proud of their cemetery, and they have no problem with the local craftsmen painting their cross in lively colors and writing self-ironical epitaphs on their behalf. You'll find epitaphs which say that the person resting there was a drunk or a womanizer, and all that in the first person singular. People are very relaxed about the verdict given by the community on their cross. Elisabetta has even gone to significant lengths to be buried here.
My husband died 7 years ago. He is buried in a different graveyard, there in the back. But I bought a place to rest here because I don't want my grave to be hidden. I want to be here, in front. Many people ask me why I didn't want to rest in peace next to my husband. I say, I've spent enough time by his side. Now I want to be here in this cemetery.
So, you have a problem with death. Come to Sapunsa and see how people here deal with it. Nothing more natural than a merry cemetery.
Irony Romanian style there, and despite our next subject being something you might be inclined to snigger at, it's taken very seriously by many. Paris has some of the world's most interesting cemeteries, with the great and good in every other tomb. Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir in the Montparnasse Cemetery, Oscar Wilde, Edith Piaf and Jim Morrison in Père Lachaise, François Truffaut in Montmartre. The list goes on, and these villages of the dead are tourist attractions in themselves. Illustriously filled cemeteries are one thing, but in the north of Paris you find the oldest animal cemetery in the world. Dogs, cats and even birds and horses are buried at the Cimetière des Chiens de Asnières. And it's not just little old ladies who lay their white poodles to rest there. RFI's Sarah Elsass has more.
The Cimetière des Chiens is on the banks of the Seine River as it curves north of Paris. When you go through the arched stone entrance, it's like going into any other Parisian cemetery, except the tombstones are smaller.
Here's a cat, has a picture of it, it's an orange tabby, and it says, Le temps passera, mais tu resteras ma doudoune. It means time passes, but you will always be my doudoune, 1991 to 2002. Here's just a flat tombstone, Notre Iago, our Iago, 1973 to 1983.
There are live cats walking around, lying on tombstones. They're well kept, covered in flowers and trinkets. This is to Ramses, 1982-1992. I think it's a cat. Pattes et mains jointes, nous avons vécu 9 années et demie d'amour. Our hands and our paws joined, we lived 9.5 years of love. Que ton absence est cruelle et dure à supporter. Your absence is cruel and hard to stand. Que Dieu nous aide. May God help us, pour toujours dans mon cœur, forever in my heart, signed, ta maman, your mother. It's easy to mock this outpouring of grief over what some say are just animals, but people tend to personify their pets and grieve accordingly when they die. Gérard Faburel takes care of pet funerals for the mortuary Mercier & Sons in Anières, up the street from the pet cemetery. People who come to him are those who've had a particular relationship with their pets, he says.
Pratiquement une relation humaine.
Almost a human relationship. For some, losing a pet is like losing a child. You can see this on what people have written on the stones in the cemetery. Faburel, who has two cats himself, says people tend to see their pets as idealized human beings.
Un animal, on n'a jamais rarement quelque chose à lui reprocher dans sa vie.
It's rare to hold a grudge against an animal, he says. Plus, an animal doesn't contradict you and always needs you.
Alors là, vous voyez les cercueils, hein, ce sont
he shows the small coffins available for cats and dogs. He arranges everything from picking up the animal from home or the vet, arranging for a coffin and a headstone, and getting the cemetery plot.
Là, c'est le modèle de luxe, si on peut dire.
This is a fancy coffin, he says, with metal handles. They start at about 200 euros and can go to 500 or more for larger ones. A cemetery plot starts at 116 euros a year. Cemetery workers fill in the grave of a cat named Pepette that died a few days earlier. Her small coffin was placed in a tomb that already houses two other animals. Their owner, a doctor wearing dark glasses, says she wants her pets buried in the ground because she has a connection with the earth. There wasn't a ceremony. She just watched the workers fill in the dirt. She then showed me a photo of her cat on her mobile phone. This is the first time she's looking at the photo since the cat died.
Pepette dans les fleurs.
Pepette in the flowers, standing amidst the tombstones. We look at photos of a black and white cat on a patio. Funeral director Faburel says that all kinds of people come to him to bury their pets, not just older people thinking of their own mortality or rich people with money to burn. It's really everyone, old and young, rich and not so rich, he says. And in the cemetery, amidst all the family pets, you do get the famous one or two.
Here is Rin Tin Tin, la grande vedette du cinéma, the big movie star.
Rin Tin Tin is the German shepherd who appeared in films in the 1930s. It's said that composer Camille Saint-Saëns and director Sacha Guitry's pets are buried here, too. For Network Europe, this is Sarah Elzis in Agnières-sur-Seine, just north of Paris.
Now, from the many ways of dignifying death around Europe, we turn to one of the least dignified ways to die, state execution or the death penalty. This week, the European Union was abuzz with fresh plans to persuade the United Nations General Assembly to adopt a resolution condemning the use of the death penalty in its member states around the world. Many key states still use it, including the US, Japan and China, but it's banned across the whole of the European Union. Portugal holds the EU's rotating presidency at the moment, and it's been spearheading the drive to get the UN resolution passed, as you'd imagine, with no small degree of opposition. Vanessa Mock is Brussels correspondent for Radio Netherlands Worldwide, and for this week's Brussels briefing, she told me that as a first step, the Portuguese are calling for a suspension to executions in all UN member states.
Well, they're trying to get a different tact on the whole thing now. They are not calling for an outright ban on the death penalty, but they're calling on countries that put criminals to death to establish a kind of moratorium on executions with a view to abolishing the death penalty in future. This resolution, of course, is not binding. It's not like a Security Council resolution, but it does have a big moral force, a big moral authority. And the Portuguese, who are really spearheading these efforts, they're heading up the EU presidency at the moment. They've also managed to get global support for this resolution so that it's not seen as a Western drive. They've managed to secure the support of two countries from each different region in the globe to also co-author the resolution so that basically you get a lot more backing when it comes down to the vote.
Do you think the Portuguese and the rest of the EU are actually serious in hoping for this to go through? And if it does go through, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because a UN General Assembly resolution isn't going to get individual member states to change its internal policies, is it?
Well, actually, that's exactly what they are trying to do. They really want to influence things. They say, you know, since the last time that they tried to get a resolution of this nature through the United Nations in 1999, a lot has changed. A lot more countries have come out against the death penalty. So in terms of getting the resolution through, they say it should be plain sailing. But the big worry is, as you say, that there's always some countries who are pushing to try and take the teeth out of this resolution, if you like. So you've got countries led actually by Singapore this time, but also with the backing of countries like China, the US, also a lot of the Gulf states who are trying to push through something called a wrecking amendment. Now, human rights groups say that basically would completely destroy the resolution because it would be a kind of clause that would stipulate that ultimately the death penalty is a matter for national sovereignty. And it wouldn't be apparently something obvious and glaring in the resolution, but it would, when it would come down to it, allow member states to kind of have a get-out clause. And now the EU is very much counter-lobbying to try and make sure that this wrecking amendment doesn't get through.
The EU's sort of on a moral high ground with this issue, isn't it? You know, as we've said, it's the EU who's trying to push this through the UN and get this resolution passed. But the issue of the death penalty has caused a big row recently within the EU itself, hasn't it? Only last month.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually been caused a huge stink within the EU ever since the Kaczynski brothers really were in charge of Poland. Just back in August, President Kaczynski said, for instance, that the European Union would come to see that the death penalty was justified for murder. Now, that, you know, he was severely rebuffed by the EU for that statement. And then earlier in October, Poland actually vetoed an EU move to declare October the 10th, the European Day against the death penalty. It's something that the EU was really, really keen to push through. It went ahead anyway, but the point is that Poland then tried to argue, well, you know, there are lots of other life violations such as euthanasia and abortion. They should also be taken into account. Aren't we being hypocritical by having a day against the death penalty? But now I think everybody's breathed a sigh of relief here in Brussels that they have a new leadership in Warsaw, and that certainly shouldn't be an issue anymore.
On the 26th of December 2004, 230,000 lives were swept away and 543 Swedes never came home. How did family, friends and Sweden as a whole meet the grieving and cope with their loss? Gabby Katz reports on how one crisis organisation aired feelings, experiences and individual stories almost 3 years after the devastating Asian tsunami.
At the Swedish Red Cross, staff formed unique ties, cooperating with other organizations during that difficult December in 2004. Now they want to reach out once more with their publication, A Different Life, a book about daring to be a human being in crisis and grief. Annika Gillespie is a coordinator for Stockholm Red Cross and one of the authors of the book she is proud to say stands out from all the others, written in the aftermath of the tsunami.
We would like to share our experiences from the work we've done with those who were affected with the tsunami, what we have learned, what we have seen, what we've heard during these 2 years. From our point of view, it's important to share the knowledge with the common people so that everybody can be the word we have in Swedish, medmänniskor. I don't know how you say that in English. Maybe you have a good word for it.
Another human being.
Right, right.
What is one of the most important things that you learned?
One of the most important things that I learned is that we talk about differences. It's not right or wrong. You don't grieve in a certain way that's considered right or wrong. It's different. And as soon as we can accept each other's differences, the better.
I was in the bungalow with my husband. We were going down to the beach, and my two girls, 10 and 8, they were down on the beach already with friends. And just suddenly, when my husband and I were on our way out of the bungalow, he screamed, "It's coming water." And then in just 1 second, he was gone with a lot of water. And I was also going away with it, but I could grab a window. I don't know how, but I could climb on the wall, on the house. I succeeded in holding on to the house. And then suddenly, after maybe an hour, all the water was gone. And I thought I was alone, but then some more people showed up, who had also climbed in some palm tree or something. And then we decided together, some people there, to try to come further up, away from the beach and the water. We stayed in a house over the night, and then we picked a bus to the airport, and I was able to catch a plane home to Sweden.
How did the Swedish Red Cross help you get back to your life here in Sweden?
They gave me a call about 3 weeks after I returned. They put me in a group with people in similar situation. They had also lost their children, and some of them their partner, like I did. And we talked about the tsunami, about what happened in the wave, and about our wounds, and about our loss, about our families, what happened to them, and about all the situation, because that was all we had in our heads, and all we wanted to do was to talk about this for a couple of months after.
Despite everything, life goes on. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I really do. Some force helps you. It's nothing that you rule over, really. It just comes power to go further and to make every day possible to live. And then day go and days and days. And then suddenly you see, yes, I made it. It's possible.
And suddenly Birgitte von Polger is smiling, explaining how she found happiness once more with another tsunami survivor. They now have a child together.
There's only just enough time left for me to tell you about this month's Network Europe quiz, very much in keeping with this week's theme. It might sound odd by the end of November, but here goes. You're about to hear three of the most popular pieces of music played at funerals in Europe. Please tell me the titles of all three. And that's all we've got time for. Do join me again next week from me, Richard Walker, and all of our European partners here on the programme. Thanks very much for listening.
And so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear. I'll state my case, of which I'm